On Tuesday, August 20th at 10 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl asks communities to stay, fight, and build as we talk to Vivian Vasquez Irizarry, director and producer of Decades of Fire, which looks at the policies of racism and neglect that still shape our communities while offering hope for today. We'll also talk to Moikansi Gama of Image Nation, who will screen the film on August 23rd. That's Tuesday, August 20th at 10 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. Listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name is Joyce Jones. And our guest for this evening is Vivian Vasquez Irizarry. She is the director and producer of Decade of Fire, which will be screening at St. Nicholas Park on Friday, August 23rd. However, we will first hear from Moikansi Gama, who is a co-founder of Image Nation. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl, starting now.
Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar.
My name is Moikansi Kama, and I'm the founder of Image Nation Cinema Foundation. And we are presenting our 17th annual Image Nation Outdoors Festival. And one of the screenings we're doing this year, out of nine, is called Decade of Fire. And it is a documentary on the fires that occurred in the 70s in the Bronx. And we're really excited to show it. The film was actually brought to us by Black Public Media. And Black Public Media is, I consider it to be a Pan-African media organization. They are one of, I think, four consortiums that were established by PBS to give voice to minority communities. And so Black Public Media is one of those consortiums. We've been partnering with Black Public Media for, I think, well over 10 years through the Outdoor Festival and also through other initiatives. So this screening is just the continuation of that relationship. But this also happens to be Black Public Media's 40th anniversary. So we wanted to do a screening that would celebrate their history of progressive work about Pan-African experiences. So I consider the Bronx to be a Pan-African community. And we're showing Decade of Fire, which is an amazing film that really gets into the history of a pretty intense period in the history of New York City when the Bronx was constantly on fire due to a lot of corruption. And this film kind of gets into the nitty-gritty of it and shows how the Bronx community responded and actually fought that corruption. Friday, August 23rd. And then we have several other screenings. On Thursday, we're going to have our Soul Train tribute. It's an annual event we do where we do a tribute to an artist who performed on Soul Train at some point in their history. This year, we're doing Aretha Franklin, and we are also attempting to break the Guinness record for the longest Soul Train line in history. Come out between 5 and 6 to get registered, and then at 6 o'clock, we're going to start this Soul Train line. And we're going to have live performances performing Aretha Franklin songs, and we're also going to show the film Amazing Grace. Another highlight on the calendar, there are 9 screenings in the festival, is Kids Night Out. It is curated by an 8-year-old Harlemite named Kari Kamagate. He chooses the film, he chooses the activities, he hosts the event, and Kari is also my son. Try to give him his own space. So for Kids Night Out, we have a backpack giveaway by the Omegas in Harlem. We're showing Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, another great Pan-African film. I think his father's African-American, his mother's Puerto Rican, so it shows the complexity of our Black experience. And the film won an Academy Award this year, so Kari, my son, is excited to show it. And then we're going to wrap up the whole festival with Grace Jones, Family and Bloodlight. That is a documentary on Grace Jones, and we're going to have a bit of a fashion show. It's going to be a very good time. There's a lot more on the calendar. If people want to know, they can visit imagenation.us, as in United States, or as in us, and the festival's all free. I hope folks will come out and have a good time. I'm the founder of Image Nation. We were established in 1997, and the goal of the organization is to promote Pan-African culture through independent film and music. We're all about celebrating the global Black experience, and we've been around for quite a while, since 97. We've been showing independent films in the parks. This is our 17th annual outdoor festival. And we have also had a 7-year partnership with Lincoln Center. We have a new partnership with the Apollo Theater starting this fall. We'll be doing a quarterly series there, similar to what we did at Lincoln Center. And we also are spinning off a for-profit business called the Soul Cinema Cafe. It'll be located in what's now known as raw space to a lot of folks, but we're going to be developing that space into the Soul Cinema Cafe. It'll be a coffee shop by day and a cinema by night where you can come see independent films any night about our experience and just independent films in general that are progressive and kind of speak to a particular mindset. Anyone who's interested in learning about us, you can go to our website, imagenation.us, as in United States, or us. You can see the calendar. You can learn more about our Soul Cinema Cafe that we're developing. We're actually doing a seat naming campaign where you can support the effort by putting your name on a seat. You can reach us there as well. Oh, another thing is that on Friday, August 23rd, when we show Decade of Fire, two of the directors will be there. Vivian Vasquez Irizarry will be there, as well as her co-director, Gretchen Hildebrand, to introduce the film and to do a small Q&A. And I think Leslie Fields Cruz, who is the executive director of Black Public Media, will be bringing a few words as well. So it's going to be a really wonderful night, and I hope you will come out. ImageNation.us, as in United States, or us.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with
Vivian Vasquez Irizarry.
Vivian Vasquez Irizarry, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl and sharing information about this wonderful film, Decade of Fire.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
I fortunately have been able to see the film. I caught it during Doc NYC in November last year. Yeah, that was the first time I saw it. And then I had an opportunity to see it again. And this was a great thing about this film. It was during a screening that was hosted by Northwest Bronx Community and Clergy Coalition, NWBCCC, in the Bronx. Yes. At our local public library. So that was great. Having said that, I now want to immediately jettison to the question of finding out, was that the goal when this film was created to coalition and exhibit the film with organizations, the community organizations?
Yeah, one of our driving intentions was that in the film we wanted to, what we call, flip the narrative about what happened in the South Bronx. And immediately we thought about the people in the South Bronx need to see this film, because we have to understand and realize that there were so many external forces beyond our control that led to the destruction of our neighborhood and our communities. Mm-hmm. And it was important. We knew that we wanted to reach a broader audience, but we also, in our hearts, knew that we needed to reach the community as well. So we, and I'm going to say that it's me, Vivian, right, Gretchen Hildebrand, Julia Allen, and Neda Martinez, the team of four who helped to create Decade of Fire, decided that we needed to get it out into the community. Julia has been a community organizer for many years. And, you know, basically, as we were working on the film, by the middle of it, her idea was like, we need to figure out how to have an impact campaign, meaning come up with a strategy for making sure that we get it out to the people in the community as much as possible. So why not contact housing justice organizations, people in the community who can host and bring the community to the space at the very local level so that they can see the film and also engage in conversations about what happened and what's next for the community. How do we continue to work on issues that affect us now?
I noticed also that Julia Steele Allen, she was involved in the first Critical Resistance Conference, and WBAI listeners would definitely know about Critical Resistance, and also she was involved in the U.S. Social Forum in 2007 as well. Well, definitely, I guess she had a lot to add with regard to mobilizing.
Right, because she had relationships, she had the context, she knew which organizations to contact. And she also made cold calls to organizations, but we credit her with doing the research about where the work is happening today, where the organizing is happening across the country. I just finished doing a tour, which she basically coordinated around the Eastern Seaboard with housing justice organizations, community grassroots organizations. So she was able to conduct research that made the connections around where redlining and urban renewal and those policies really impact the communities and where the groups that are doing that work now. And so we basically mapped out a strategy to present the film in these communities.
And just to let people know, there's going to be a screening on the 23rd, Friday, the 23rd of August, in St. Nicholas Park, and it is part of a Black Public Media 40th anniversary event that's being presented by Imagination Cinema Foundation. Now, you sound giddy about that.
So exciting. It's just so exciting. There was a point at which we just felt like, oh my God, are people going to be interested in this story? Do people care? And then one of our funders became Black Public Media. It was just amazing. And we've had a great relationship. So to be able to film it in the park in collaboration with BPM is just fabulous. We're excited. I'm excited.
Are you going to be there for the Q&A by any chance?
Yes.
Yay!
Of course. Yes.
Now, tell people about this film. When I saw it, it actually seemed like, it almost seemed like your dissertation, the amount of information that was in this film.
So it is the story about why the South Bronx was left to burn. And so I say left to burn because a lot of people, outsiders, believe that the South Bronx burned and that landlords burned the buildings for profit. Yes, that happened. But what we wanted to do was to think about, learn about, and show, well, what led that to happen? What created that sort of vulture effect in the South Bronx? And it really started beginning in the 40s and 50s with redlining. You know, redlining, as many people know, started in Brooklyn, right? But it came into the Bronx, and redlining, I think our audience knows this, where resources in a particular community are sapped. There are no access to loans, no access to mortgages. There's no access to capital in a community because some folks decided that because people of color lived there, those neighborhoods were not worth investing in. And so our communities were left high and dry, right? We had no access to resources, no access to economic development, housing development in our neighborhood. We talk about urban renewal and what that did and led to the migration of 100,000 people from Manhattan to the South Bronx, which caused overcrowding in a place that was redlined. We talk about white flight. We talk about the creation of highways by Robert Moses. And we talk about all these different external factors that led to, was like an ambush, if I may, of the Bronx, of a community. Planned shrinkage, although not an official policy. There are no resources. We're experiencing fires. We have limited access to services, very limited access to public services, and nobody does anything about it. The government doesn't do anything about it. No one's here to support us. And so people take matters into their own hands. So what the film not only does besides explore these policies that destroy the community, but we also celebrate those unsung heroes that sacrifice their lives to save their block, save their community, and save the South Bronx. Because at one point, you know, I believe that there was a plan to get us all out of there, displace all of us to create something else for others. But we didn't. We survived. We stayed. And we fought for our community. And we're still fighting for our community now.
Tell me about the advocacy group, 52 People for Progress.
Oh, man. So 52 People for Progress is an organization comprised of neighborhood people. It started with a group of young people led by a gentleman by the name of Albert Quinones, who decided that the park was in shambles. It really was. And that was my playground park. I went there. We played. In fact, my sister got bitten by a dog there. You know, we played there constantly. We were in that park all the time. And the basketball court was falling apart. The handball court was falling apart. The swings had already fallen apart, and Al and a bunch of volunteers decided that they were going to take over the park and renovate it and rebuild it and bring music to the park. Eventually, the idea was, well, let's bring some culture because, you know, we need culture in our community. We thrive. And so the park still stands today. It is still managed by the people, the volunteers. For years, I also volunteered because it's like going home. Every summer, there are concerts that are held there for the community. It's just a wonderful place. It reminds us of our childhood. It reminds us of our survival. It reminds us of the possibilities, what we can do to keep our community thriving, to keep us going, and to celebrate each other.
So I noticed that Eddie Palmieri came out of that community. Did he ever come and perform concerts?
He has, And Ray Barreto and Sammy Sosa and Tito Nieves. I mean, a whole bunch of artists come and perform. Even Bernie Williams
from
the Yankees performed there. A host of musicians have come to play at 52 Park.
I want to say a few words to you guys that I've been thinking about backstage. And the thing is this. For men, for all mankind, there should be never no walls, never no fears. Only one thing in life, liberty in the coming years. Bye-bye. I'd like to bring now the well-known Felipe Luciano.
¿Qué pasa? What's happening? Salam alaikum. How's it going, brothers and sisters? Brothers. We have only a few minutes, so I just want to put a poem that will put us in the kind of mood that will allow us to listen to the rhythms that we know so well. So many times we have the kinds of conflicts that make us more apart than we are as a people. And we know as a people, black and Puerto Ricans have their destinies out before them. And we're going to keep on moving and build a nation for all of our people. One poem, and it's called Jíbaro, My Pretty Nigger. Now, the thing about Jíbaro is that we used to consider him the hick, but in fact, he is the ancestor. And bloods, as we often say in the South, if you love someone, that's my nigger. So it's called Jíbaro, My Pretty Nigger. Jíbaro, mi negro lindo, de los bosques de caña, caciques de luz, tiempo's una cosa cómica. Jíbaro, my pretty nigger, father of my yearning for the soil, the land, the earth of my people, father of the sweet smells of fruit in my mother's womb, the earth brown of my skin, the thoughts of freedom that butterfly through my insides. Jíbaro, my pretty nigger. Sweating bullets of blood and bedbugs, swaying slowly to a softly strummed five-string guitar, remembering ancient empires of sun gods and black spirits and things that were once so simple. How times have changed men. How men have changed time. Unnatural, screams the wind. Unnatural. Jíbaro, my pretty nigger man. Fish smells and cane smells and fish smells and cane smells and tobacco and oppression makes even God smell foul. As foul as the bowels of the ship vomited you up on the harbors of a cold metal city to die. No sun, no sand, and no palm trees. And you clung, yeah, you clung to the slimy rib of an animal called a marine tiger in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Amen. Jíbaro, did you know you my nigga? I love the curve of your brow, the slant of your baby's eyes, the calves of your woman dancing. I dig you. You can't hide. I ride with you on subways. I touch shoulders with you in dances. I make crazy love to your daughter. Yeah! You my cold nigga man. And I love you cause you mine. And I'll never let you go. And I'll never let you go. You mine, nigga. And I'll never let you go. Forget about self. We're together now. And I'll never let you go. Never, nigga. Que viva.
This is technically a music program, and so I'll just be playing music that was on the Fania label. Mm-hmm. It just gives me excuse to play it.
You know what? This is my own personal thing about the film.
Uh-huh.
You know how expensive it is to have the copyrights to all this music?
Yes.
So my favorite from back in the day was Salma Cosa.
Oh, okay.
We just couldn't afford it. So the last minute, we still had it in there.
Oh, my gosh.
We were trying to get people to give us a better price on the cut, but we couldn't. I was just so upset about that. So if you have the rights to play Salma Cosa,
I do.
That would be
That's
great.
Right.
man, nuestro man. Goma, 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 goma. Tanga tipo, ombu tanga, nelfa makosa. Alumuna, sisi au, yasa makosa. Amuna yeye, koma, sama kosa. Tanga tanga, umbu tanga, ne sama kosa. Nika so. Mama ko, mama sama ko makosa. Mama ko, mama sama ko makosa. Mama ko, mama sama ko makosa.
Had a composer. Well, the one main song we had, Apache.
Okay.
Right? Which is everybody's
right.
Song. Everybody plays that. We wanted Samacosa, but then we had to go with a composer to compose. It became cheaper to do that than to
right.
play
Makes
some of the
simple.
Songs we wanted.
I can play all the Fania mm-hmm. songs I want to play, and I love Samacosa as well. So.
Del cielo cayó una rosa. El mar la envolvió en su seno, con besos de sol y arena. La rosa se volvió una perla, borinquen bella esmeralda, de música y de poesía, milagro de las Antillas. Azúcar, sabor por hijos y por extraños. Rafael, bordaron tu cancionero en oro de Finamey. Borinquen, mi querida Borinquen, bendita por siempre seas, y que viva mi Borinquen.
So much that I appreciate from this film and so much that I was able to take away from it. But the thing that I really appreciated was how it personalized the story. Your story was included in this because, as you said, you grew up in the areas that were affected. Your friends were affected by this, and you tell part of that story. How did you decide that that is something you wanted to tell?
How did I decide that? That's interesting. And it's also interesting that you say that the film comes off as a dissertation, because at the beginning stages of the film, I was doing voiceover and I was describing in the film and explaining the policies. But we held several feedback sessions with folks in the community and outside the community. And a key feedback that we received was, well, who is Vivian? Why is she telling this story? You know, why is this so important to her? Then we began to sort of pull out the story in terms of, okay, so for example, the building of the highways, right, was a policy that helped to isolate the South Bronx, right, and choke it economically. Mm-hmm. So we talked about it in terms of the community. And then eventually we began to talk in circle and say, well, Vivian, how did that affect you? How did that affect your family? I'm like, oh my God, I couldn't go to Hunts Point. Oh my God, my brother was mugged there once. Oh my God, you know, like, and then I began to remember and pull out all the memories of how having the Bruckner Expressway specifically run right through my neighborhood, how that impacted my block and my neighborhood and the people that I lived with. And then we began to look at the different policies and say, oh my God, like, for example, when we explored redlining, then I began to talk with my mom and my sister, and my mom was like, yeah, we just couldn't get a mortgage. You know, your dad was trying to get a mortgage. We just couldn't do it. I'm thinking, oh my God, that's how it impacted directly. We couldn't get a mortgage. And so we began to think about how all of that impacted me and my friends and the lack of services. Like, wow, you know, it's not in the film, but while I grew up, the hospital in my neighborhood was the old Lincoln Hospital.
Oh, wow.
And it was at that point officially a condemned hospital. My health service was held in a condemned hospital.
Wow.
And the only thing that was open was like a program for nursing and then also the emergency pediatric ward. But that was it. That was our health system.
Wow.
So we sort of say, oh yeah, you kind of like on the day to day, and this was actually my life before I decided to do a film. It's like, oh yeah, you know, Lincoln Hospital was a bad hospital. hospital, everybody says, oh yeah, Lincoln was terrible. But we didn't realize that it was because there was a government decision to condemn and cut services in the hospital, which impacted my neighborhood, my community, my family, my neighbors. And so we looked at all these different policies and thought, wow, look at all these connections that we're making because of the way that people made decisions to just completely abandon us. And so call it what you want. I call it structural racism and outright discrimination.
Yeah, your part of the story had to be told here. Definitely.
Yeah.
Por la esquina del viejo barrio lo vi pasar, con el tumbao que tienen los guapos al caminar, las manos siempre en los bolsillos de su gabán, pa' que no sepan en cuál de ellas lleva el puñal. Usa un sombrero de ala ancha de medio lado y zapatillas por si hay problemas salir volado, lentes oscuros pa' que no sepan que está mirando, y un diente de oro que cuando ríe se ve brillando. Como a tres cuadras de aquella esquina una mujer va recorriendo la acera entera por quinta vez, y en un saguán entra y se da un trago para olvidar que el día está flojo y no hay clientes pa' trabajar. Un carro pasa muy despacito por la avenida, no tiene marcas pero todos saben que es policía. Pedro Navaja, las manos siempre dentro del gabán, mira y sonríe y el diente de oro vuelve a brillar. Mientras camina pasa la vista de esquina a esquina, no se ve un alma, está desierta toda la avenida. Cuando de pronto esa mujer sale del saguán y Pedro Navaja aprieta un puño dentro del gabán, mira pa' un lado, mira pa' el otro y no ve a nadie. Carrera, pero sin ruido cruza la calle, y mientras tanto en la otra acera va esa mujer refunfuñando, pues no hizo pesos con qué comer. Mientras camina del viejo abrigo saca un revólver esa mujer y va a guardarlo en su cartera pa' que no estorbe. Un 38 Smith & Wesson del especial carga encima pa' que la libre de todo mal. Y Pedro Navaja, puñal en mano, le fue pa' encima. El diente de oro iba alumbrando toda la avenida. Quiso fácil, mientras reía el puñal le hundía sin compasión.
You're listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar My Bowl is the name of this program. My name is Joyce Jones, and our featured guest for this evening is Vivian Vasquez Irizarry, director and producer of Decade of Fire. I'd like to thank Moikansi Gama of Image Nation for giving us information about the Image Nation Music and Film Festival screenings that's taking place throughout the summer. What you're listening to right now is Pedro Navaja, Willie Colon, and Ruben Blades, from Siembra, a 1978 Fania Records release. And as I mentioned, I will be rummaging through the Fania label, and by default, Tico as well, since Tico Records was bought out by Fania. Before that, the title selection from Soul Makossa from Manu Dibango, 1973 Atlantic Records. Before that, you heard Jibaro from Felipe Luciano and the release Eddie Palmieri recorded live at Sing Sing with Harlem River Drive, 1972 Tico Records, the introduction by Paquito Navarro, the MC. Before that, we heard Bang Bang, Joe Cuba Sextet from Wanted Dead or Alive, aka Bang Bang, Push Push Push, 1966 Tico Records. Before that, we heard Eddie Palmieri, Condiciones que Existen, from Eddie Palmieri's Coco Mango 1973 release, Sentido. Before that, we heard another selection from Sentido, Puerto Rico. The personnel includes Eddie Palmieri, piano, producer, Ishmael Quintana, vocal, Jimmy Sabater, background vocals, Andy Gonzalez, drums, Barry Rogers, trombone, Nicky Marrero, bongos, percussion, timbales. And, of course, we started our program with our theme from Nina Simone, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl. This is from The Very Best of Nina Simone, Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972. Originally recorded in 1967, this is from a 1998 RCA BMG compilation. Stay tuned for our On the Bandstand segment with associate producer Hank Williams and more from Vivian Vasquez Irizarry and our discussion about the film Decade of Fire right here on Sugar in My Bowl on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl continues.
8 millones de historias tiene la ciudad de Nueva York.
La vida te da sorpresa, sorpresa te da la vida. Ay, Dios.
Como decía mi abuelita, el que de último ríe se ríe mejor.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for August 20th, but don't go anywhere. Joyce Jones is coming back in a few minutes for another hour of Sugar in My Bowl with Vivian Vasquez Irizarry, director of the documentary film Decade of Fire. And there will be a free outdoor screening in Harlem St. Nicholas Park on August 23rd, and that's sponsored by our friends at Image Nation. Also look for it on your local PBS station this fall in November, and we'll let you know when it's showing in the New York City area. But in this segment, we highlight area shows of Sugar and My Bowl guests so you can see them live. And we've got a lot of shows to announce this week. We start with guitarist Julian Lage, who's at the Jazz Gallery with Chris Davis on the 21st and 22nd. Pianist Harold Mayburn leads a quartet at Smoke from the 22nd through the 25th. Drummer Andrew Surreal leads a quartet at the Village Vanguard with guitarist Bill Frizzell and pianist David Bideas from the 20th through the 25th. Drummer Terry Lynn Carrington is at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem for a talk on jazz and gender justice on the 22nd. Bassist Mimi Jones is at Smalls in an after-hours set on the 22nd. Pianist Vijay Iyer is at the Stone with Matana Roberts on the 24th. And the annual Charlie Parker Jazz Festival returns this month with several events around town. Saxophonist Renee McLean is at the Harlem Rose Garden on the 23rd. Vocalist Dee Dee Bridgewater, saxophonist Ravi Coltrane, harpist Brandy Younger, and vocalist and multi-instrumentalist Camille Thurman are all at Harlem's Marcus Garvey Park for a free outdoor performance on the 24th. Saxophonist Lakeisha Benjamin closes out the festival at Tompkins Square Park on the 25th. Pianist Mark Carey's Harlem Session Series continues with weekly late Saturday night sets at Smoke on the 24th and 31st. Vocalist Catherine Russell is at Dizzy's Club from the 26th through the 28th. Bassist Linda Mahon O is at the Jazz Standard with Fabian Almazan on the 27th and 28th. And pianist David Bideas is at the Jazz Gallery with Jonathan Blake on the 27th through the 28th. Saxophonist James Brandon Lewis leads a trio at The Glove in Brooklyn on the 28th. Looking a little further ahead, saxophonist Gary Bartz is at Smoke for a Charlie Parker tribute from the 29th through September 1st. Drummer Bobby Sanabria leads the Multiverse Big Band for a free outdoor concert in an afternoon set at Harlem's Riverbank State Park on August 30th. Vocalist and multi-instrumentalist Camille Thurman is at Birdland for a Charlie Parker tribute on the 30th and 31st. And the Sun Ra Orchestra, led by Marshall Allen, is at Brooklyn's Union Pool on September 1st and the Clemente Soto Velez Center on September 6th. And we've got word from Vision Fest promoters Arts for Art that their fall season of events is beginning, and it starts with a tribute to the late poet Steve Cannon at the Clemente Soto Velez Center on September 6th with poetry and music. You can expect to see bassist William Parker, dancer Patricia Nicholson Parker, saxophonist James Brandon Lewis, who all join poets for the celebration, with a closing performance by the Sun Ra Orchestra. And the Arts for Arts series continues throughout the fall with performances in Gardens, at the Weeksville Heritage Center in Brooklyn, and over Columbus Day weekend in East Harlem, and we'll give you more info on all those as the dates draw closer. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. And sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website. And if you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too, where we'd appreciate likes, tweets, and shares with your friends. And if you really like what we do, please help the station stay on the air by pledging whatever you can and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. The support WBAI link on our website has details, and we're grateful for any help you can give the station. This is Hank Williams signing off with our new weekly schedule. We'll be back on air next Tuesday night at 10 p.m. and have updated event listings online. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
Check this out. This is Chuck, your public enemy number one, the rebel without a pause, bringing the noise and fighting the power right here to the Sights and Sounds. That's right, Sights, 99.5 WBAI.
Yeah, and it wasn't easy, right, because it was painful to see that we were really left. We were left alone. Mm-hmm. We were left to fend for ourselves. And just to say that, yes, the city was going through a fiscal crisis,
right?
The city was undergoing bankruptcy, but not all communities were left alone.
Right.
Not all communities were abandoned. Not all communities were starved of services.
And the statement from Ford to the city, to Mayor Beam, didn't exactly apply to every community, but it definitely applied
to yours. That's right.
And for those who may not be aware, Ford told the city to drop dead.
Drop dead. Mm-hmm. Right. And eventually we received services, but then what happened, right? The city of New York York established this financial control board, which was made up of bankers, not one single public servant on this board. And what did they do? They continue to cut services in the South Bronx and in other places across the city where people of color lived, in, you know, the Lower East Side, Bed-Stuy, Williamsburg, in the places where people needed services the most, that's where they cut.
And part of those services is, of course, most importantly, the fire department. And I like how the film speaks to the neglect and the active cutting back that took place at that time.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find someone who actually wanted to talk?
You know, I have to tell you that that wasn't an issue. That wasn't a problem. We asked if we can come to conduct research at the fire department. We asked if we can interview and bring our cameras, and they said it was okay.
Wow.
I get this question more often than not about, wow, they were able to admit and talk about it. Yeah, it was not like they were hiding anything.
Right.
They gave us the information.
Just the facts.
Not difficult. Yeah, it was just the facts. And the fire department suffered too because, yeah, while these decisions to close the firehouses came from the top, was also like the firefighters, right, the union workers who were really suffering as well.
Right.
Because they were fighting fire after fire after fire after fire. It affected and impacted them in very negative and harsh ways as well.
Sure. And they were short staffs.
And they were short staffed. And
right.
The union was constantly fighting to stop the cuts and to continue to provide fire service.
Por levantar la virtud y la moral de los hombres. La discordancia no deja nada. Vive tu vida y no diga mal lengua entero.
Sujétate, la lengua, sujétate.
Oye, que lengua más larga y misterina, caballero, la que tiene voz de espina.
Martín.
in presenting this in a film form. Who approached you with that? Did you go to somebody and say you want to do it, or did somebody approach you and say this should be done?
So Julia Allen and I work together in a nonprofit organization in the Bronx, and we actually helped start one of the small New Visions high schools at the beginning when the Bill Gates Foundation began to fund the small schools and tear down the large schools in the Bronx. And so we were working together and started to think about a curriculum for an incoming ninth grade group to teach them the history of the South Bronx or of the Bronx. Unfortunately, that curriculum was never taught. We never got to teach it. But that spurred conversations between Julia and I about my experiences growing up in the Bronx. And being the community organizer that she is, she just kept asking me, like, what happened? Are you for real? Like, your family sometimes had to sleep with their shoes on? Yeah. You know, like, wow. You had so many fires. Like, tell me more. And she encouraged me to do some writing about it. And as silly as it sounds, she called me one day and she said, we have to do a film. This is important. We have to do a film. And so eventually she introduced me to Gretchen Hildebrand, who is a filmmaker.
Yes.
And Gretchen began to film conversations with me and people that I grew up with from back in the neighborhood. And we talked just about how it was living back in the day in the community, the fun that we had. We played softball. We played so much. We did so many things, like with the gangs. We cleaned up neighborhoods. We went to each other's parties. We held all kinds of events and block parties. But always in those conversations, you can hear in the background was the fires.
Right.
And these wonderful memories that we had of growing up in the Bronx would somehow lead to sort of this shared collective pain of, like, my God, what happened to us? You know, like, oh, my God, you remember that fire? Yeah, you remember that fire? You remember so-and-so? And then you remember when so-and-so died? You remember when so-and-so got arrested? So there's this sort of, I don't know what to call it, but it's like a beautiful, emotional, bittersweet mix of the great times we had together and the suffering that we all experienced at the same time. So we began to film and film and film and then conduct more research. Like, why? Why did this happen? Mm-hmm. Hold on. Let's just find out why these fires took hold. I didn't know that 80% of the housing stock in the South Bronx burned. We just knew. We would talk amongst ourselves. I would say, oh, yeah, there were fires all night. And my sister would say, no, no, there were fires all day.
Wow.
And, you know, just the other day we had a screening at one of the gardens on Fox Street. And this man came up to me and he says, I can still smell the smoke.
Wow.
You know, we all have that shared memory. And
sure.
And my response to him was, yes, I could smell the smoke, too. I could smell it during the day. You know when it's close. You know how it feels when it's far. You know how it feels when it's at night. You know how it feels when it's during the day.
Wow.
Like, we all have that shared experience. But going back, well, we decided that we needed to conduct research and find out, like, why? What happened? How did 80% of the housing stock burn? How did that happen? And we found out that we had an average of like 40 fires a day and night.
Wow.
That's amazing.
That is insane.
It is insane, yeah.
The archival footage that you incorporate in the film, I understand there are two people who were involved in getting that together. Was it Rachel Antel and Jennifer Petricelli?
Petricelli, yeah. They helped us so much. And the call was put out there. We're doing a film about the South Bronx, and people were very generous in providing, sharing some of their documentaries. I don't particularly know their names. I wish I knew. But there were people filming and folks who wanted to document and make their own documentaries of what was going on in the South Bronx in real time, but they never got to, for some reason, I would bet financially,
sure,
they never got to finish their film. So they were just generous enough to provide us with that. And then, you know, there were also visits to ABC, NBC, CBS. We just asked everywhere. We just searched and searched. But we had a lot of time. It took us a while to get the film completed.
How long did it take?
It took us about 10 years.
Okay. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent.
Yeah, we joked that it took a decade to make Decade of Fire.
Right.
You know, because at the beginning it was sort of, again, lots of conversations, lots of figuring out. We talked to a tremendous amount of people in the community, and we were trying to figure out how to shape the story. Eventually, really give it that, what filmmakers call the emotional arc, put me in there in my family story, and then obtain funding for it, because at the beginning it was difficult for us. We had a very successful Kickstarter campaign, but then eventually the funds dried out.
Sure.
And so it was sort of like an ebb and flow. But throughout those years, we consistently met and just made a commitment to getting the film done.
Noticia, noticia que yo te traigo.
One of the things that I like to say very proudly of is that the making of this film in all its forms was built on a consensus model. We all worked on it together and we made just about every decision about the film together as a team. That required a lot of time.
Yeah. It's like even longer when you get consensus.
That's right.
There's another organization that is featured prominently in the film, Banana Kelly. Could you tell me about that?
I think that one of the most beautiful moments for me in making this film is sharing the Banana Kelly story. I mean, there was a family, a couple, Mr. and Mrs. Potts, who actually lived on Kelly Street, and Mr. Potts had a building, and he worked in Hunts Point, and he worked full-time as a laborer, and then in the evenings would come home and work on his building on Kelly Street. And eventually, he was able to buy one or two and three more buildings on Kelly Street. Now, this was during the time when he did not have access to loans, again, because of redlining. He didn't have access to any kind of capital support, any resources to maintain his buildings, but he did it basically all by himself. There's a scene that was cut in the film, but he says, "My blood is in all these buildings," because he cut himself, his blood, sweat, and tears. His whole life was in maintaining those buildings. And he's the inspiration for Banana Kelly, because when folks began to see Harry and his son-in-law, Robert Foster, and Leon Potts, his son, began to see that everything was falling apart, they decided that they needed to save Banana Kelly. They needed to keep, they needed to rebuild that block. And they did it brick by brick, just knowing that it came from family. And oh, and by the way, Mr. and Mrs. Potts, they also fostered a whole bunch of kids in the neighborhood. They took care of the neighborhood. They are the example of love for the community, love for your people in your neighborhood. And they're the inspiration of what became Banana Kelly. So when people began to renovate and rebuild, it wasn't that difficult to recruit. Theirs is an example of an amazing, vibrant social connection that people had. The social fabric of this block was just phenomenal. People worked together, people cried together, they laughed together, and they fought for that block. That's an amazing story, you know. And they were actually inspired by the People's Development Corporation as well, where it was folks who's in the midst of all the destruction and abandonment began to think innovatively outside the box. Hey, wait a minute. We can take this over. We can take over this building and we can fix it and we can have people live in it. We're going to do that. We're going to take this apartment, and we know that Senora Tomasa and Miss Jones here, they're living in an abandoned building. We're going to take this apartment. We're going to fix it so that these ladies can live in that building. Right. And it took a lot of grit, and it took a lot of sort of innovation and love of community to do that. I am just so pleased that we were able to include their story in the film.
Oh, yeah. And there's more to learn to that story. When you see Decade of Fire, we didn't say everything here. There's so much more, and it's really good to see that story in the film.
Yo nací en La Habana Vieja, me crió la Ña Teresa, mi padre fue blanco claro, mi madre no sé quién era, mi madre no sé quién era, por eso es que soy morena, y en la sangre de mis venas, tengo fuego de pantera, mi madre no sé quién. Blanco claro, ay mi madre no sé quién era, mi madre no sé quién era.
And the complete name of the organization is Banana Kelly Community Improvement Association, Inc.
Correct. Improve. Don't move.
Improve, don't
move. That was their motto.
And there's a motto on your homepage. What is it? Rebuild?
Yeah. Save, fight, build.
Yes. Save, fight, build. Mm-hmm. Was that your idea, or was that something that came as you worked on the film?
Well, yeah, we were working on a tagline, and I think that it came out of all of us. I think that eventually, I think it was Julia that kind of finessed it for us.
Uh-huh.
But again, as we're making this film, making the real-time current connection to what's happening now. We have to stay in our community now more than ever.
Right.
We don't see aggressive fires burning and displacing us anymore. Mm-hmm. But what we see is aggressive real estate takeover in our neighborhood. We have to stay. We have to fight for our neighborhoods. We have to build because it's happening all over again.
Which is what I was to mention after the groups like Banana Kelly clean these spaces up. It's in different neighborhoods. After they go in, do the work and fix things up, then some realtor from somewhere comes in and wants to, or the city decides, oh, well, we're going to take that. So I believe you told that story as well in the film.
Right. Yeah, well, gentrification is here. It's real. And we have to, there are communities all over the city, groups all over the city that are fighting it. Yeah, we know it's coming, but we also have to put a stop to it. We have to figure out a way. And I have to tell you that there are strategies that are being implemented in different ways. Mm-hmm. And folks have to just pay attention, get involved. One of the things that I keep hearing in all the screenings that we've done in the community is that there are some people that know about it and there's some people that don't realize the impact that these takeovers, this gentrifying process is going to have on our communities. Mm-hmm. And we need to continue to educate people. We need to continue to have people understand what that means and give people in the community a voice for how they want their community to look like and be. Because we all want development. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants development. Everybody wants a nice neighborhood.
Right.
And that's what I mean. People want safe, affordable housing. People want to be able to feel like they're part of a community. Right. We all want that. But we all then have to be a part of the process for defining what that means for
us. Right. Right.
He viajado por todo el mundo y nunca, nunca pude encontrar una guayaba que me gustara y detuviera mi caminar. Y aunque encontré una casa dorada, esa guayaba no pude hallar.
solo de boca. Afinación.
Provide links to the organizations that you have partnered with in the past, like Banana Kelly and other sources, which I strongly suggest that people contact these organizations and find out how you can assist in preserving your neighborhood. Also on the site, there are links to resources that are to come. There's a high school curriculum that you're working on?
Yes.
Do you want to tell us about how you
envision it? We're circling back, and we have been working with a group of teachers from the South Bronx to help us develop a curriculum that would be connected to the film, but that's broad enough for teachers from all over the country to use and teach with their students, so that the overall kind of like framework of the curriculum is to engage high school students and, you know, there's a group of middle school teachers who are involved too, engage young people in creating projects and lessons around what has been the narrative of your community and sort of exploring what are the narratives that have been said, because, you know, the film is to flip that narrative.
Right.
And then the second part of the curriculum is, so let's conduct an analysis. Is it true? Is the narrative true? What is the real narrative of our community? And then the third leg of the curriculum asks students to then reimagine and create their own narratives for their community, how they want their community to be. So we're very excited. We're working with a bunch of very intelligent folks who have been excited about our film, and, you know, we can sort of talk about gentrification, or we've talked about redlining for so many hours, but we are putting something together that can be shared with teachers and people in after school programs who work with young people and can even be taught in a senior center, you know.
Mm-hmm.
places for people to talk and really delve into an analysis of what community means and to the importance of reshaping our story. And, you know, no one else can tell our story but us. There have been so many stories told about us. Mm-hmm. We now need to really begin to continue to tell our own stories.
Exactly. This film is going to make a PBS appearance in November. November 4th, I see here, as part of Independent Lens. Congratulations.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you. That was a major goal of ours, and we're just so happy that we're able to have it nationally broadcast. We're very excited.
But people do not have to wait. They can go to St. Nicholas Park and screen the film there on Friday, August 23rd. It's from, they have here, 6 p.m. to 10:30 p.m.
Right.
And there will be Q&A with Ms. Vivian Vasquez Irizarry. And if you have further questions, you can do that there. That's the only difference in relying on just seeing it during Independent Lens. But for those who aren't in New York, and until you make your way to seeing them, by the way, are you on your way to screening in another town?
I have just finished a tour of the Southeast and a little bit of the Northeast. So we've screened from Miami to St. Louis to Boston, Philadelphia. Oh, my God, I've been to so many places. We were in Providence, Rhode Island. We were in Baltimore, Maryland, going to Buffalo, and I'm going to be going to Rochester soon. So we have been traveling, and then the next phase of our engagement work is to take it to the Southwest and take it to Puerto Rico.
Okay.
So right now we're in the process of trying to raise money to have it be seen in Puerto Rico as well. You know, we even went to Appalachia in Eastern Kentucky.
I was thinking about that. Okay.
And it was so interesting because it was so well received. Yeah, it was very interesting and it was a great experience.
Because people would look at this film and think of, you know, just without thinking, they would think automatically that it's just an urban, you would reach a conclusion that would only be identified in an urban setting. But yes, Appalachia.
Yeah, well, no, in my experience having participated in all these screenings, people are resonating with the film because they see how their own communities have been neglected.
Exactly.
They're making the connections with redlining and urban renewal and, you know, white flight and gentrification and the housing crisis that we're now all experiencing everywhere.
Right.
People are making those connections very strongly to the film. And believe it or not, everywhere I go, there's always someone from the Bronx.
Oh, that's funny.
It's like, oh, I'm from the Bronx. Oh, my mother's from the Bronx. You know, it's just really amazing.
Excellent. Get around. Those Bronxites.
Con el llanto de tus ojos y las manos sin destino te vi partir. Destino cruel y así mató todo el amor que nos unió. Ay, adiós, qué triste fue el adiós que nos dejó al partir, ya sin voz de llorar. Partir regresar a mí, al estar tu voz, sin tenerte aquí. ¿Quién fue que así mató nuestro destino sin razón? ¿Por qué vivir así? ¿Por qué tanto dolor? ¡Ay, adiós! Este fue el adiós, amor, qué enorme soledad me quedó sin ti. Thank you.
qué vivir así? ¿Por qué tanto dolor? Ay, adiós, adiós, qué triste fue el adiós, amor. Qué enorme soledad.
Now, is there anything else you want to tell the WBAI Sugar in My Bowl listening audience about Decade of Fire that we may not have discussed?
Well, just if people want to follow us on Facebook or Twitter, if people want to send us a note about their own experiences, I'm always very humbled and I want to hear people's stories because I think it's a shared story. And if people just want to send us a note about the film or about their experience, or if they have a question about where they can get involved in their own local community, please reach out to us.
And the website is decadeoffire.com.
Fire, yes.
Oh, thank you so much, Vivian Vasquez Irizarry, for sharing about Decade of Fire. And people, make sure you make your way to St. Nicholas Park on Friday, mm-hmm. August 23rd at 6 p.m. There's also an Eventbrite Catch Decade of Fire presented by Image Nation Outdoors Film and Music Festival and the Black Public Media 40th anniversary. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the time you spent with us.
Thank you so much. I feel honored and just so happy that WBAI has supported the film and is putting us out there. Thank you for the shout out.
And see you in the park.
Okay. Take care.
You're listening to the closing moments of Sugar in My Bowl. My name is Joyce Jones, and I'd like to thank both our guests, Vivian Vasquez Irizarry, the director and producer of Decade of Fire, and Moikansi Kama, Image Nation. What you're listening to is Koro Miyare, Fania All-Stars, from a compilation Que Pasa, the best of the Fania All-Stars. This was originally released in 1978 on Fania Records. This is from a 2002 Sony Music compilation. Personnel includes Johnny Pacheco, percussion and vocals, Nicky Morero, timbales, Luis Porco Ortiz, trumpet solo, Bobby Valentin, bass, Papo Luca, keyboards, Roberto Roena, bongos. Before that, we heard Adios from La Lupe, her 1966 Tico Records release, Isu Alma Venezolana. The personnel includes La Lupe vocals, Jose Quintero bass, Luis Rangel cuatro, Ramon Brito harp, Danilo Barros piano, Frank Hernandez drums. Before that, we heard Power from Ray Barreto's 1970 Fania Records release, Barreto Power. Before that, we heard Buscando Guayaba from Willie Calhoun and Ruben Blades, another selection from Siembra, the 1978 Fania Records release. Personnel includes Ruben Blades vocal, Jose Professor Torres on piano and Fender Rhodes. Before that, we heard Rinkin Kala from Celia Cruz and Willie Colon. Cruz and Colon, only they could have made this album, the 1970 Fania Records release. Personnel includes Celia Cruz vocal, Willie Colon bass trumpet and coro, Papo Vasquez trombone and Milton Cardona congas, chicare and coro. Before that, we heard Ove la Noticia, Hey, the News, from Ray Barreto, another selection from Power. Before that, we heard, I'm going to try my best, Su Citate la Lengua, from Eddie Palmieri. Originally released in 1965 on Tico, this is from a 1996 Fania re-release. Mozambique. Personnel includes Eddie Palmieri, piano, composer, Ishmael Quintana, vocals, Manny Okendo, bongos, timbales, Jose Rodriguez, trombone, Barry Rogers, trombone. And of course, before that, we heard our On the Bandstand segment with associate producer Hank Williams. Stay tuned. Anne-Marie Hendrickson is next with Mansion of the Rat, or Rat Mansion, and more on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.